Most companies allocate their brand budget based on what the founder cares about most. But the customer has a completely different set of weights. Different dimensions matter to them. The gap between those two weight sets is not a preference difference. It is a measurable investment error.
Right. It's structural.
Four things today. The founder weight projection problem, why your gut about what matters is calibrated to you, not your customer. How to measure the alignment gap. The Goldilocks zone for design versus ambient signals. And why the economic dimension is the only adversarial one in the entire framework.
It's a packed agenda.
It really is. Welcome to the deep dive. I mean, I'm just so glad you're joining us today because the sources we're unpacking, specifically the R7 spectral resource allocation preprint and, well, a stack of fascinating internal research notes, they are going to completely rewrite how we think about product market fit.
Oh, absolutely. And to set our mission for today right up front, we are going to be looking at all of this through the lens of spectral brand theory, or SBT.
Right, which breaks demand down into those eight measurable dimensions.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Things like the semiotic dimension, which is your visual and aesthetic branding, or the experiential dimension, you know, the actual utility and quality of the product. So we aren't just looking at binary yes or no demand anymore.
We're looking at a spectrum.
Right, we're looking at a spectrum. And our goal today is to bridge the massive gap between human perception,
yeah,
that we intuitively think matters, and operational investment, which is where the money actually goes.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the way founders naturally build businesses is, it's kind of at the core of this whole issue. I mean, if I start a company, I'm naturally going to allocate my budget based on the features that took me the most effort to build, right?
Of course. That's human nature.
Or just the things that I personally value the most. Like, if I care deeply about the underlying engineering, I'm going to spend my marketing dollars talking about that engineering. It feels incredibly logical to me as the creator.
It feels logical, sure. But the sources point out that this is actually a structural flaw. They call it founder weight projection.
Founder weight projection.
Yeah. We have to be clear here. It's not that the founder is acting irrationally or being egotistical.
Right.
It is a structural property of how human perception works. You built the product. You know exactly which features required the most blood, sweat, and tears. Therefore, you are structurally predisposed to invest heavily in communicating the value of those specific features.
Because they matter to you.
Exactly. The trap is that you implicitly assume your target customer shares your exact perceptual weights.
And the data shows they almost never do.
Almost never.
Let's walk through a specific example from the research, because seeing the numbers really brings this to life. Imagine a founder who absolutely obsesses over product craft.
Okay.
In SBT's eight dimensions, this founder might weight the ideological dimension, you know, their mission, their ethical sourcing, at a 0.7 out of 1.
Which is high.
Very high. And then they weight the experiential dimension, the sheer tangible quality of the product, at a 0.9. They are optimizing entirely for craft and purpose.
Right. But then you analyze an observer cohort, the actual target audience buying luxury goods in that space.
Yeah. What do they want?
Well, that luxury cohort might weight the social dimension, meaning status, tribal affiliation, peer endorsement, at a 0.6.
Okay.
But if you look at the founder's profile, the founder might barely register the social dimension.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they score at a 0.2. They think social signaling is superficial, so they just refuse to invest budget into it.
Which means they are systematically underinvesting in the exact dimension that actually drives their customers' purchase behavior.
Precisely.
And it gets even more comical when you look at a budget buyer. The sources show a budget buyer might weight the economic dimension, price, and accessibility at an overwhelming 0.9.
Oh, easily.
But the craft-obsessed founder, they barely register the economic dimension at a 0.1. To them, price is just an afterthought to the quality. It's the classic founder who thinks, well, if I build this beautifully enough, my customer won't mind missing rent this month to buy it.
Yeah, we've all met that founder.
We absolutely have. And it leads to a catastrophic disconnect. The beautifully crafted product loses to a cheaper, better marketed competitor.
And the founder walks away thinking, oh, the market just doesn't appreciate quality.
Right. But the market does appreciate quality. The mechanism of failure is simply that the founder optimized for the dimension the customer weights fifth instead of the dimension they weight first.
That's exactly it.
It makes me think of an analogy. It's like a chef cooking this incredibly elaborate meal using only the spices they personally love.
Okay, I like where this is going.
Let's say they spend 80% of their ingredient budget on saffron. but they are completely oblivious to the fact that their dinner guest literally lacks the taste receptors for saffron.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The guest physically cannot taste it, but the chef keeps pouring money into buying more of it, wondering why the guest isn't blown away.
That's a great way to look at it. And to take your chef analogy a step further, the chef isn't just wasting money on saffron. They are actively neglecting the salt and pepper that the guest actually craves.
Yes, exactly. And the sources point out two distinct failure modes here, which I think is a crucial distinction. The first is basically what we just described with the chef weight projection.
Right.
You and the customer are both looking at this same dimension, like the experiential quality of the food, but you value it drastically differently. You're putting your chips on the wrong square.
Yeah, you're misaligned.
But the second failure mode, spectral blind spots, that's the one that really terrifies me. That's not just a disagreement on value, that's a total lack of vision.
That is the far more dangerous scenario, yes.
Yeah.
A spectral blind spot occurs when a dimension is entirely invisible to the founder.
Like they just don't see it at all.
They have a true 0.0 sensitivity to it. And because they cannot perceive it, they cannot diagnose the problem. A weight projection error can eventually be corrected if you realize your priorities are misaligned. You just adjust the budget. But a spectral blind spot means you literally do not see the battlefield. You are completely unaware that your brand is failing to emit signals on a dimension that your customer absolutely requires to make a decision.
That is wild. Every brand budget ever built started with the founder's weights, not the customer's. That's the default. Demand-first design makes the customer's weights the starting point.
And that shift is revolutionary because it moves us from guessing to measuring. You don't fix a blind spot with better intuition or a creative brainstorming session. You fix it by measuring what your customers actually weight using cold, hard data.
So how do we actually fix this blindness? How do we literally see the gap between the founder and the customer?
Well, you have to map it.
I want you to picture a specific visual. Imagine two radar charts side by side. The first shows a founder's investment allocation across the eight dimensions. It's highly spiked on the semiotic and narrative axes, but completely hollow on the experiential and social ones. The second chart shows the same brand's customer weight distribution, highly spiked on experiential and social, but super low on semiotic. If you overlay them, that physical geometric space between the two shapes, that is the alignment gap.
What's fascinating here is that this is not just a conceptual metaphor. The alignment gap is the mathematical distance between these weights on an eight-dimensional simplex.
Wait, an eight-dimensional simplex?
Yes. The R7 spectral resource allocation theory actually proves this. It shows that this geometric gap is the primary driver of wasted brand investment.
Okay, let's make sure we ground that, because if visualizing overlapping octagons in your head while driving or doing the dishes is tough, think of it like an audio mixing board in a recording studio.
Oh, that's good.
Your brand is the song, and you have eight sliders, your dimensions. As the founder, you've pushed the semiotic and narrative sliders all the way up.
Right, you're spending a fortune on the visual design and the story.
Exactly. But your customer is listening to this track, and they only care about the heavy bass, the economic and experiential sliders. You are pumping maximum volume into a frequency they literally aren't tuned to hear.
That mixing board analogy is perfect because it highlights the mechanics of the math. When we say an eight-dimensional simplex, we mean we can literally calculate the distance between your slider positions and the customer's preferred slider positions.
But how does a qualitative feeling, like how much someone cares about your brand story, become a computable geometric coordinate?
Through forced ranking surveys and conjoint analysis.
Conjoint analysis.
Yeah. You don't just ask a customer, hey, do you like high quality? Because everyone says yes to that.
Right, obviously.
You force them to trade things off. You ask, would you rather have this product with a compelling ethical mission or the exact same product for $20 less?
Ah, forced choices.
Exactly. By forcing thousands of these trade-offs across a cohort, the algorithm assigns a numerical weight between 0 and 1 for all eight dimensions.
Okay, so you get their coordinates.
Yes. You then take your actual budget, categorize every single dollar into those same eight buckets, and convert your spend into a 0-to-1 scale.
Mm.
The difference between their survey coordinate and your budget coordinate is the alignment gap.
So you're literally spending millions of dollars on a shape that your customer's brain doesn't even recognize.
The alignment gap is not a marketing problem. It is a geometry problem, and it has a number.
That blows my mind. But here's where it gets really interesting. Once you calculate that number and you know exactly where to invest to close the gap, the next logical assumption is that you should go in and tightly control every single signal in those high weight dimensions.
Right, that's the impulse.
You think, okay, my customer cares deeply about the social and experiential slider, so I'm going to perfectly architect every single micro interaction on social media and in the unboxing experience. But the sources say that level of micromanagement is a massive trap.
It's the illusion of total control. In the SBT framework, we have to differentiate between design signals and ambient signals.
Design versus ambient.
Yeah. Design signals are the things the brand explicitly controls. It's your ad campaigns, your pristine packaging, your carefully crafted press releases, the lighting in your retail stores.
The stuff you pay for.
Exactly. Ambient signals are externally generated and largely uncontrolled. It's organic word of mouth, messy Reddit threads, competitor framing, cultural commentary on TikTok. It's the chaotic noise around the brand.
And the research points to an optimal balance, right? A Goldilocks zone between the pristine and the chaotic.
Yes. The math points to a very specific Goldilocks zone, 55 to 65% designed signals.
That feels surprisingly low. I mean, if I'm a founder spending millions, I want to control 90% of what people hear. Let's explore the bounds of this zone. What happens if you drop below the lower bound under 55% design signals?
If you drop below 55%, the brand becomes too ambient. You lose the ability to steer the perception cloud.
Because you're just not speaking loudly enough.
Because you have no intentional signal architecture. Your customers just receive whatever happens to be floating around in the culture. The brand is essentially a passenger to public opinion.
You're at the mercy of the internet, which is a terrifying place to leave your brand equity.
It really is. But the upper bound is just as dangerous, if not more so.
Wait, really? How?
If you go above 65% design signals, the brand feels over-engineered. Modern consumers have incredibly sensitive authenticity alarms. When everything is perfectly polished, meticulously scripted, and entirely controlled by the corporate office, those alarms go off.
Oh, because it feels fake.
Exactly. Without enough messy, organic, ambient signals to validate the brand's claims, a phenomenon called brand conviction simply cannot take hold. The observer never truly believes the signals are real because they lack independent third-party verification.
Okay, wait, what about Hermès? I have to push back here because the sources specifically mention them and they seem to break this rule entirely.
That's a great point.
Right. Hermès controls absolutely everything. They dictate the store experience. They artificially constrain the supply of Birkin bags. They refuse to discount. They manage every single stitch of their narrative. I'd guess they operate way above that 35% bound, maybe closer to 90%. Why doesn't it hurt them? Why don't they trigger the authenticity alarm?
The framework explicitly accounts for this, and it's a crucial nuance. Hermès is the exception, but they earn that right strictly through the temporal dimension.
Contemporal dimension, so heritage, the sheer weight of time.
Decades and decades of compounding heritage. Time is the one dimension that a competitor cannot replicate with a massive funding round, and no technological disruption can erase it.
You can't fake 100 years.
You can't. That deep generational history acts as a massive anchor for their authenticity. It provides so much underlying validation that they can afford to heavily over-engineer their current design signals. Because of that century of history, the brand feels authentic even when it is 90% controlled. The history itself does the heavy lifting of the ambient signal.
That makes perfect sense. They have a 100-year-old ambient signal working for them in the background.
Exactly. But here's the critical takeaway for everyone else. Most brands do not have a century of history.
Right, obviously.
If you don't have that massive temporal foundation, you cannot play by Hermès rules.
Mm-hmm.
You must operate within the 55 to 65% zone to balance your signal intentionality with perceived authenticity. If a five-year-old startup tries to control 85% of their signals, they will just feel synthetic, corporate, and completely untrustworthy.
So if we are orchestrating this delicate 55 to 65% mix of signals, it begs the question, what exactly are those signals interacting with? That brings us back to the eight dimensions themselves.
Right.
And when you look at them, semiotic, narrative, ideological, experiential, social, cultural, temporal, and economic, almost all of them feel like a win-win scenario.
The user are.
Yeah, I mean, if I improve the experiential dimension by making a much better product, the customer wins and the company wins because we can charge a premium and build loyalty. If I improve the narrative dimension, the customer gets a better story to belong to and the brand builds equity. But the sources highlight that one dimension hides a massive trap. The economic dimension plays by completely different rules.
The economic dimension is the only one where helping your customer hurts your balance sheet. Every other dimension is a positive sum.
That is such a stark way to frame it. Let's dig into that mechanism. Why is it uniquely adversarial compared to the other seven?
If we connect this to the bigger picture of business strategy, the economic dimension is the only axis where the customer and the company has structurally opposed interest.
Opposed interest.
Yeah. Lowering your price undoubtedly creates immediate, immense value for the customer. They get to keep more of their money, but it directly destroys company value by shrinking your margins. This is why pure price competition is ultimately self-defeating.
Right, it's a race to the bottom where the winner is just the last one to go bankrupt.
Exactly. The other seven dimensions allow a brand to create massive value for the customer without destroying their own bottom line. You can increase cultural resonance or social status infinitely. Making your brand cooler doesn't inherently cannibalize your profit margins the way dropping your price does.
That's a huge distinction.
It is. Therefore, the economic dimension cannot be locally optimized. You can't just tell your team, hey, let's maximize customer value by dropping our prices to zero.
Because then the business ceases to exist?
Right. The economic dimension has to be managed as a strategic bridge. It is the mechanism by which the perceptual value you have built in the other seven dimensions gets converted into revenue.
So it's a translation mechanism.
Think of it as an exchange rate. You optimize the other seven dimensions to build a dense, valuable perception cloud in the customer's mind, and you manage the economic dimension to capture that value back for the business.
So, if you're listening to this, you might be looking at your own spreadsheets right now. We've talked about simplices, the alignment gap, the mixing board analogy, the Goldilocks zone, and adversarial dimensions. How does someone actually apply this to their own operations tomorrow morning to fix their trajectory?
They need to run what the sources call a spectral resource allocation audit.
Okay.
It's a highly practical, actionable process. First, you take your current operational spend, your actual budget categories, line by line, and you map them directly to the eight SBT dimensions. You look at where the dollars are literally going, not conceptually, but financially.
So ignore the glossy marketing deck. Look at the general ledger.
Exactly. How much are you actually spending on semiotic design? How much on experiential quality, like customer service and supply chain materials? How much on narrative? You quantify your current state. Then you compare that actual spend to your customer weight. Estimates the conjoint analysis data on what your target observer cohort actually cares about.
This is pulling up those two mixing boards side by side.
Yes. The resulting gap is the audit. It instantly highlights where you are pouring capital into dimensions your customers ignore, and where you are starving the dimensions that actually drive their purchasing behavior.
And once you find that gap, you just shift the budget and you're done.
Right.
You just slide the budget from the narrative slider over to the experiential slider.
Well, if only it were that simple.
I knew there was a catch.
This raises perhaps the most important operational point in the entire preprint. Brand investment compounds over time. The sources emphasize that brand decisions are non-ergodic.
Non-ergodic. Let's translate that. Ergodic usually means things average out over time. So what does non-ergodic mean in the context of spending money?
It means that a wrong allocation in year one structurally biases year two. You don't just lose the money you spend. You build organizational infrastructure around that mistake. Yeah. If you spend your first 2 years over-indexing heavily on narrative and visual design, when your cohort actually wanted experiential quality and robust customer support, you build specific muscles. You hire branding agencies, you build content teams, you establish supply chains geared toward aesthetics rather than durability.
You've built the wrong machine.
You formed a perception cloud in the market that is pointed in the wrong direction. Those early moves compound. You cannot just average it out by spending differently in year three.
Because by year three, the customer has already decided who you are. Demand-first design isn't just a one-time workshop where you move some numbers around on a whiteboard.
No, it is a recurring operational discipline. You have to constantly audit your resource allocation against your cohort's weights to avoid drifting into irreversible trajectory risks. And the math behind this is unforgiving. If a dimension's perception drops too low for too long, it reaches what the researchers call an absorbing boundary.
An absorbing boundary, meaning a point of no return.
Precisely. If your experiential quality is so bad for so long, that perception is fully absorbed by the market. The observer's trust is gone forever, and no amount of future spending on the narrative dimension will bring it back. Game over for that dimension.
Wow. It's a completely different way of looking at business architecture. You aren't just building a product, you're actively managing an eight-dimensional signal portfolio where every dollar shapes a geometry in the customer's mind. The rigor behind this is incredible. And just to remind you, the rigorous math behind everything we've discussed today comes from the 20 research papers on Zenodo, specifically pointing to the R7 spectral resource allocation preprint.
It's heavy reading, but it's worth it.
Definitely. If you want to go deeper on how SBT connects to brand strategy more broadly, episode 2 is the practitioner's overview. If the operations side of resource allocation is more relevant to you, the specification layer underneath brand. Episode EOST1 covers how to run operations with the same demand-first logic.
And, you know, we spend this entire deep dive talking about the alignment gap between human founders and human observer cohorts. But what happens when the entity making the purchasing decision is an AI? Large language models and recommendation algorithms are synthetic observers. They have their own spectral profiles. They weight narrative and ideological text heavily, but have absolutely zero sensitivity to the experiential or social dimensions. As algorithms increasingly buy on our behalf, how big is the alignment gap between your brand budget and the AI that's evaluating you?